Part 2, The Philosophical Investigations.
Wittgenstein, after writing the Tractatus, left philosophy, having decided that he had nothing more to say. Why did he return to Cambridge and return to philosophy?
Well, there are several levels, I think, on which one can answer that question. I mean, what he explicitly says is that he had come to realize that the Tractatus contained grave mistakes. And one of those mistakes was the one that we discussed last time, the doctrine of independence. Elementary sentences are independent of each other. That was initially, when he came to realize that that was wrong, and he wrote a little article called Some Remarks on Logical Form, which was published then, to recant on that view. That was the initial spur to bring him back to philosophizing. But I suspect that there were deeper reasons. I mean, he was a natural philosopher. He'd taken a long break, and he felt that it was time to get back to business.
How would you sum up the overall aim of the Philosophical Investigations? What's this book about, if you were to give it a synopsis?
Well, at a very general level, I would say it's about the same thing as the Tractatus, namely how language bears on the world. What is the relationship between language and the world? To what extent is the world a product of language? That's a very, very general characterization. Of course, once you descend down into the mist and fog of detail, there are a lot of differences. But at a general level, I think they're essentially trying to do the same thing.
One of the most iconic quotes from the Philosophical Investigations reads as follows. For a large class of cases of the employment of the word meaning, though not for all, this word can be explained in this way. The meaning of the word is the use in the language. What does Wittgenstein mean by this? The meaning of a word is its use in the language.
Well, he means that language is a public institution, broadly speaking. This is a point that he makes again and again in different ways in the investigation. It's language use is spread out over time, so that meaning should not be thought of as something instantaneous, but as something that arises from the use of words over time.
So this idea that the meaning of a word is its use in language. In the Tractatus, we see that the words come first. They are what has meaning. When they're constructed into a complex sentence, that's where the complex sentence has its meaning from. But in this sense, in the Philosophical Investigations, are we saying that the sentence comes first and the meaning of the words is contingent on how they're used within a sentence?
Yes, we are saying that. But I just want to put in the rider that, again, I don't think that's very different from the Tractatus. So basically what you've recapped there is the Phrygian context principle, which says only in the context of a sentence does a word have meaning. That principle occurs in the Investigations fairly early on, but it also was mentioned by Wittgenstein in the Tractatus. And as I think I mentioned in the earlier podcast, in the Tractatus too, the sentence is the primary unit of meaning. And words are an abstraction from sentences. So that seems to me not to be a point of difference between the Tractatus and the Investigations. What is a point of difference is that Wittgenstein is much more alive in the Investigations to an even wider context than the sentence, namely the context of the whole community and of its uses of language, the way it uses language. That plays very little role in the Tractatus. I don't think it plays no role at all, but it's certainly not emphasized in the Tractatus, let's put it that way. But it comes to be emphasized in the Investigations.
Language within the role of the community, then. This idea of language games comes out, doesn't it? What does Wittgenstein mean by language game?
That's not an easy question to answer. I mean, he introduces the idea in connection with a particular description of what he calls a simple language game played by builders. But he then goes on to use the notion of language game in lots of other contexts, and it gets expanded so that, for example, religious discourse or ethical discourse can be thought of as a language game. Basically, the idea of a language game is of some kind of relatively contained system, in which things make sense in terms of that system, but there may be an external point of view from which they don't make sense or don't make the same sense as they make within the system. That's broadly speaking what the idea of a language game is.
So would an example of that be something like, well, one of the ones that gets used of, like, so if you take the game of chess and have the pieces on the board and people who understand the context of what all these pieces are, but if you remove the king from the board and present it towards somebody who is not aware of how this actually functions, then the meaning of this word king doesn't actually have any meaning outside the language game that you would be playing.
Yes, that would be right. And I think that Wittgenstein, I don't think he would say that chess itself was a language game, but certainly games in general would count as a kind of language game, because there are certain rules, there are certain ways of doing it. It's an institution game playing, and you have to get into that institution to see the point of it.
Quoting here from Wittgenstein 120 from the Philosophical Investigations Part 1, you say the point isn't the word, but its meaning, and you think of the meaning as a thing of the same kind as the word, though also different from the word. Here the word, there the meaning, the money, and the cow that you can buy with it. What's Wittgenstein getting at here?
What he's getting at there is that he thinks that we shouldn't regard meaning as a kind of coordinate object with the word, an object set over against the word. Which is, as it were, its exchange value. That's where the economic analogy comes in. A cow is itself a form of money, but it's also an object that you can point to. For Wittgenstein, we shouldn't think of meaning as being some kind of object that you can point to in that way. It's more like the institution of money itself. That's to say, it's a practice. It's a system that we operate rather than an object, almost a physical object that you can point to in the world. And this is to unpack the slogan that meaning is use. Meaning is use in the way that money is use. So if we think of money in abstract terms as an institution, not as bits of paper and coins, then the analogy says that, we shouldn't think of the meaning of a word as its exchange value in some kind of currency, but rather the whole institution of currency itself. That's the way the analogy works. The whole institution of buying and selling, which is a practice that extends over time and gets its point from its temporal dimension. If you took a snapshot of a commercial transaction, that, you know, split second, that on its own would not make sense. It only makes sense as a commercial transaction if you put it in a wider context, of the practices of a whole community over time. And Wittgenstein's saying, well, the same applies to meaning.
Another quote here from page 223. So if a lion could talk, we could not understand him. What's Wittgenstein making this mark for?
Well, there he's appealing to his idea of a form of life. That's a phrase that he uses several times. And his idea is that having a language and living a form of life are two interconnected things. And the language only makes sense in the context of a particular form of life. That's what gives it its being. And his point with the lion is that a lion's form of life is so different from ours that if it did have a language, we simply wouldn't be able to translate it, because there wouldn't be enough points of contact. There wouldn't be enough things that we could identify with and understand in the lion's form of life that would give us an entry point into interpreting the language. That's his claim. I mean, I actually think it's clearly wrong. I mean, it's pretty obviously false to say that, because in many, many fundamental respects, a lion's form of life is extremely similar to ours. It is a biological creature. It has to feed. It has to sleep. It has to mate. It has to excrete. It has to go through all the biological functions that we have to go through. And so there are very many points of reference in a lion's form of life that are immediately accessible to us. And if a lion did have a language, that language would perforce be about those aspects of the lion's life. And in fact, I mean, I think actually the reverse of what Wittgenstein says is true. If a lion did have a language, it would actually be pretty easy to interpret it for us, because we're more complex beings relative to the lion, and I think it would be a fairly simple language to interpret.
got a couple of quotes here, which I think are interesting in emphasizing this point. John Churchill saying, "Who has not rubbed a dog's ears or scratched beneath a dog's chin? Our capacities for communication with dogs surely are rooted in their shared mammalian nature." Another one from Roland, who says, "Both the lion and I have interests in eating, sleeping, sex, avoiding encroachments on our environment, and so forth, about which we could make doubtless small talk." Now, it seems like Wittgenstein has got this wrong, if this is what he means, but does this not fall into a passage of the Philosophical Investigations where he's talking, I think a couple of lines before, he's talking about this weird culture of people who they don't have the same human behaviors and they're very difficult to read. So is there another interpretation we could pose here that perhaps Wittgenstein isn't saying that we wouldn't understand the lion because it's culturally different? Maybe he's saying that it's just so, we just can't read its behavior. And I guess you'd have to adopt the view that Wittgenstein is very much a behaviorist in the investigations to take this line. But is there any alternate understanding which we can, can we save him from this criticism?
I don't think so, because we do understand a lion's behavior. It's very easy to understand. There's no problem there. But, I mean, it's not an isolated remark, which we can simply discount. It connects with a lot of other remarks that Wittgenstein makes in his later writings, where he tries to imagine alternative forms of life. For example, he has scenarios in which people use rulers that expand and contract arbitrarily and still do something that can be called measuring. He has another scenario in which people sell wood according to the area it occupies on the ground. So if you take a pile of wood and spread it out over a larger area, these wood sellers say now it's more wood and costs more. And again, he wants to be able to say, well, they are buying and selling wood, but they're doing it in a fundamentally different way from the way we do it. The problem that Wittgenstein faces with these examples, and where I think his later approach is slightly naive, is on the question of translation. I mean, this is an irony, actually, because Wittgenstein is very much alive to issues surrounding translation, and he has inspired a lot of later work by Davidson and others on the problems of translation. But I think he himself rather ignores it. He tends to assume that we, as it were, sitting in our philosophy seminar, can make sense of alternative forms of life, even though in practice we would not really be able to translate these other thinkers, because the form of life as described is so strange that we wouldn't have the required entry points into their language to make sense of them. And then there would be pressure on us to say, and this is a point that Davidson makes explicit, that these people or beings aren't really speaking a language at all. If we can't translate it, if we can't find any entry point into it, if we can't interpret them as rational beings doing, broadly speaking, the same sorts of things as we do and engaging in the same world, then what reason do we have to suppose that they're speaking a language at all? It might just be twitters like birds. You know, it might be completely meaningless noise. So Wittgenstein wants to occupy a rather awkward halfway house position in his later writings, where we're entitled to say that there could be alternative forms of life, even though in practice we wouldn't actually be able to interpret or understand the language spoken by the beings in this other form of life. So we wouldn't in practice have a good reason to say that they were in fact speaking a language. So going back to the lion, if a lion could talk, we certainly could understand him. And if we couldn't, then we wouldn't have a reason to say that he was talking in the first place. That's the point that goes missing from that quote, I think.
What is the private language argument and why is it significant?
The private language argument occupies the central section of the investigations, and it's really the cherry on top of the cake, as far as the later Wittgenstein is concerned. It's in many ways the most interesting, most radical part of his work. And it has enormous significance. It might seem initially as though it were a rather small question. The question is whether someone could speak a language which nobody else understood. That would be how Wittgenstein conceives of a private language argument. So we're defining the word private. It's not the language that Robinson Crusoe speaks or that somebody speaks when they're on their own. This is a language which cannot be understood, logically cannot be understood by anyone else. And he's concerned to attack that idea, show that it's incoherent. But The wider implication for that is really that in doing so, he unpicks the whole Cartesian subjectivist tradition about mind. So although it starts off as this in a way connects with your initial question about the interest of philosophy of language. Although it starts off as what looks like a rather picky question in the philosophy of language, it opens out into a very big question in the philosophy of mind, which is really the question what mind is, where it's located, to what extent the subject has infallible or specially privileged access to his own mind. And the idea essentially is that if the Cartesian tradition were right, if the subject were in the first instance acquainted with his own mind and everything else came after that, so the world and other people's minds that came afterwards, if that were the right order of proceedings, then it would make sense for the subject to invent his own language, to speak about his own private sensations, his own private mental states, a language which nobody else could understand. That idea ought to make sense for Descartes, but it doesn't. So unwinding, the Cartesian position is wrong. That's a sort of broad thumbnail sketch of the overall significance of it.
So he would argue then that, so if you had a very young child who's yet actually grasped the language of the culture they're in, that whatever inner monologue, if there even was one for this child, could not be anything other than what they're already picking up from, say, their parents or the surrounding. There could be no truly private voice there. Is that right in saying?
Not private in this technical sense. That's to say, a language other people couldn't understand. He's not ruling out the possibility of some genius coming along and inventing his or her own language and speaking it, but it would have to be a language that others could in principle interpret and understand.
It would have a relation to the fundamental structure of language. It would be comprehensible.
Yes, and it would relate to the subject's environment, and that would be the way we would get our entry point to it. We would see how the subject was interacting with his or her environment, and that would give us our way into interpreting and understanding the language.
Let us pause for a moment and hear a quick message from our sponsors, the New College of the Humanities.
My name is Jess. I'm a third year student here at NCH, which means I only have 9 months left, which is really sad. I study philosophy with English, and I'm also the president of the student union. There are many ways you can get involved with the union. One is you can come to our meetings. We're always welcome to having guests. We actually really love it. You could join the events committee, which works alongside the events officer to plan everything that happens in NCH. Elections happen at the end of the first term, so you'll have had an entire term to settle in, to figure out where your place is in NCH, and then you can run for a position on the union yourself. Like many students, my first year at university was a bit of a challenge. I experienced some mental health difficulties. I started experiencing anxiety and had the occasional panic attack. And being at NCH, I received the most incredible support I could have ever wanted. My friends and my fellow students, who I wasn't even that close to, were always there for me. And the systems that we have in college are fantastic.
Liberal arts-inspired degrees in the humanities and social sciences. Gold standard teaching with one-to-one tutorials and small interactive seminars. Lectures by world-renowned professors including A.C. Grayling, Daniel C. Dennett, and Steven Pinker. You can still apply directly to NCH London for 2018 entry and be considered for a scholarship. Find out more at nchlondon.ac.uk/PennSciCast. NCH London. Unique degrees for curious minds.
The link to reach the New College of the Humanities is in our iTunes description and on our website. Right, back to the discussion. The notion of rule following is a particular point of scholarly interest. What is this idea of rule following and why should it be of interest to us?
It's of interest because rule following is a fundamental part of our life, and in particular, it's a fundamental aspect of language use. When we use words with meanings, and we are there following rules. We're not just using the words randomly. We're using, in some sense, we're using words in accordance with their meaning. there is such a thing as correct use of language and incorrect use of language. And that distinction between correctness and incorrectness, that normative distinction, is essentially what Wittgenstein is exploring in the rule following considerations. He's trying to get at what exactly it is for a use of language to be correct or incorrect. What is the standard that we're applying there which enables us to say that? And where does the whole idea of normativity, the whole idea of ideality, if you like, come from? What's its basis? What's its justification?
So if language is contextual or determined by our cultures and abilities to play along in other people's language games, then we should abide by the rules that we set out communally? Is this the idea that in order to have effective, meaningful language, we need to make sure we're following the rules that develop? Is this the right way to articulate it?
I think it's not quite that. It's not so much, I mean, the way you put it, it sounds like a piece of practical advice, which of course it is. If you want to be understood, you'd better play by the rules. But he's not so much saying that, I think, as asking more deeply, what is it to play by the rules? What is it to use a word correctly or incorrectly? And certainly, as you say, the community plays some role in his answer. It's been a big matter of dispute among commentators exactly what that role is. Some people have taken a rather, what I think of as simplistic line, according to which basically what the community says goes. The community is right. Mm-hmm. So using a word correctly is using it in the way that the rest of the community would use it. They have the say-so on whether you're using a word correctly or not. And the community itself is not subject to any standards. It itself does not have to meet any standards of correctness. It can do whatever it likes, and it is the final arbiter on determining whether a word is being used correctly or not. Now, that's a position that some commentators have advanced, Kripke most famously. There's got to be something right about it, because obviously, and this connects with the point that meaning is use and use is extended over time. Ultimately, you might say, and over time, the community is the arbiter of correctness and incorrectness. So if a word comes to be used in a community in a certain way, then that simply becomes correct usage. Fine. But the sort of simple communitarian interpretation of Wittgenstein that you get sometimes in the secondary literature doesn't, I think, work, because it, for the reason that I hinted at a minute ago, it doesn't allow the community itself to go wrong in any way. It doesn't make room for the idea that the community might not follow its own rules. It simply says, well, look, if the community says this is the way to do it, then that's the way to do it. It sets the rules. Now, as I say, in the long run, I think it does set the rules, but I don't think it sets it in the short run. So we can make sense of the idea that a community might, as a whole, go wrong in following a rule. It might make a mistake. That idea makes perfectly good sense, at least in the short run. And so that means that what it is to follow a rule can't simply be a matter of doing what, if you ask them, the rest of the community would say you ought to do. There has to be room for normativity at the level of the community itself and not just at the level of the individual rule follower.
You mentioned Kripke a moment ago. If the meaning of a word is its use in language, I think this is right when Kripke takes this to its end and forms the skeptical problem that if the meaning of words is their use in sentences, then does that mean that words themselves are meaningless? So does that mean that all of language is essentially meaningless if we take it to its end? Is this right?
Well, you were alluding there to the context principle again. The meaning of a word is the way it's used. It's the way it figures in a sentence. Mm. That doesn't mean that words in themselves are meaningless. It means, on the contrary, they're meaningful, but they get their meaning from their role in the sentence and their use in the language. Kripke's skeptical puzzle is not quite that. It's that Kripke's skeptic wants us to point to a fact which constitutes our meaning one thing rather than another by a word, and which justifies our meaning one thing by another by a word. So if we come to a new case, we've learned a word, we've used it in a certain way up till now, okay, we come to a new case, something we haven't encountered before, and the question is, does this word apply here? And Kripke's skeptic is saying, well, what makes you sure that it applies in one way rather than another, or what justifies you thinking it does apply correctly, and what does that actually mean? And of course, the skeptic thinks that you can't really point to any fact which would justify your using the word in one particular way rather than another. So to give a simple example, we've used the word blue up till now to refer to the color, which is my folder here, which I have in front of me, is blue. But suppose we go into the next room and there are various objects there, and I point to what you would call a green object, and I say, well, that's blue too. And you say, no, that's not blue, that's green. Now, what is going on in that dispute? What makes one of us right and one of us wrong? And is it the case that one of us is right and one of us is wrong? Well, Kripke's skeptic says that there's nothing you can point to in your past usage of the word blue which would justify you applying it in one way rather than another. Maybe, to put it in sort of ordinary natural terms, maybe the way you've been using the word blue was such that it was supposed to start applying to green objects after a certain point in time. Blue objects up to time T and green objects thereafter. Maybe that's actually what the meaning of the word blue is and has always been. Is there anything in your past usage or in your mental states that you can point to which would rule that out? And the skeptic argues that there isn't. And I think indeed the various facts that the skeptic considers, so facts about your past training, facts about your dispositions, facts about the phenomenology of your mental state, these indeed don't determine meaning. I think the skeptic is right about that. And I think that Kripke's argument is pretty Wittgensteinian. Wittgenstein himself spends a lot of time arguing against what was really the Lockean conception of meaning, that meaning is fixed by phenomenology, that it's fixed by sensations, mental states that have a phenomenological quality to them. So part of Wittgenstein's polemic in the Investigations is against that Lockean theory of meaning. But I don't think that Kripke's skeptic is right in, or when I say right, I don't think Kripke's skeptic really represents Wittgenstein accurately when he says there is simply no fact of the matter about what your past usage would justify at this point. I think that Wittgenstein thinks there is a fact of the matter. There are determinate meanings, and they do divide possible uses into correct and incorrect ones. At some level, the community plays a role in setting up those determinate meanings, but it's not quite the simple connection that Kripke's skeptical solution envisages it as being, namely that whatever the community says at time t goes for that time t. I think Wittgenstein is willing to allow that the community itself can go wrong.
Do you have I guess we've had the color, but is there an example that, because color there is more of a, I guess, a subjective nature to it, but is there anything in which you can think of where a community has decided upon something and then, as you said, almost broken the rules of how they've decided to use a particular type of word or language?
Okay, well, consider Kripke's own example is an arithmetical one. So he imagines that you're performing a sum that is larger than any sum that you've calculated before. And he asks the question, or his skeptic asks the question, well, what makes one answer right and the other wrong? And what makes it the case that one answer accords with your meaning, with your intention, and the other not? Now, you could imagine a scenario in which there's a kind of a mass hallucinatory phenomenon or a mass madness in which the whole community is subjected to a drug and wakes up the next morning saying, well, 5 + 3 is actually 6. And that's what we've always meant by addition. That's a very small sum, of course. That's not larger than we've ever encountered before, but I'm making it simple. And in that situation, and maybe you would have one person, one isolated person who'd somehow managed to escape this drug, who said, no, guys, wait a minute, 5 + 3 = 8. That's addition. That's what we always meant by it. Now, if the rest of the community, everyone else in the world, insisted that 5 + 3 = 6, according to the sort of Kripke skeptical solution, that would have to count as the right answer. and this isolated individual would simply be wrong. But I think intuitively we would say that that individual was actually right and the rest of the community was wrong, at least in the short run. Of course, if the rest of the community persists and goes on, you know, day after day, year after year, saying, no, no, 5 + 3 = 6, then the meaning of the word plus would change to accord with the new usage, and 5 + 3 would indeed then become 6 in accordance with the new usage. But initially the community would be wrong. Kripke's skeptic doesn't allow us to say that, but I think intuitively we'd want to say that.
Well, I suppose with that example, we have the issue that if, particularly with mathematical ideas, that to have the whole of the, like, that community disagree, like, surely you'd have the issue of just, well, if it's like a tautology, like, you couldn't, like, how, well, I guess what I'm trying to say is that at least you could, the person could argue a pretty good case as to why they as the individual were right and the community were wrong. But is there anything where it's perhaps less clear cut, where, like, where they might not be able to do such a thing?
The trouble is, to make the example tractable, you have to use rather small numbers, as Kripke himself does. But if you take a much larger sum, so a sum that no one has ever computed before, a very, very large sum indeed, then if one person came along and said, well, the answer is this, and the rest of the community said the answer is that, what could either of them point to in their past usage to justify their position? And that, in a sense, is Kripke's point. There isn't anything they could point to, and then the weight of numbers would simply kick in and the individual would be outnumbered. But sort of stepping back from it and considering that as a philosophical scenario, a thought experiment, I think we can see that there are circumstances in which we onlookers would say, well, actually, no, the individual is right. The individual is using the word plus in accordance with past usage here. And it's the community that's gone wrong. And as I say, we can make that kind of scenario vivid by, I mean, here's a sort of more updated version, the sort of Day of the Triffids version I gave you a minute ago. Just imagine some alien community managed to hack into our brains and alter the software so that we started using the word plus differently. But this alien community, by mistake, missed out one person, me, say. So I go on saying, look, M plus N is, and I give what the community would previously have given as its sum. But now the rest of the community, having had their brains tampered with, say, no, 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 it's not that, it's something else. Well, as I say, in that situation, I think it makes sense to say that I'm right and they're all wrong. I'm using the word plus in accordance with its previous usage. But as I've mentioned, if their error persists, then it's at some point it ceases to be an error, and we would say that the word plus has now changed its meaning. They, of course, would not accept that it's changed its meaning, but they would be wrong about that too.
So what impact does this text have on religious and ethical language?
Well, of course, Wittgenstein doesn't really discuss either religion or ethics in the investigations. They occasionally get mentioned. He does have an interesting parenthesis at one point where the parenthesis reads, theology is grammar. And in remarks he makes elsewhere, not published in the investigations, but in other forms, we know roughly what he means by this. He means that moves in a religious language game, if we can think of religion as a language game, are to be thought of as grammatical moves. That's to say that they're to be thought of setting the terms in which one thinks about what happens in the world. So they set the parameters. In a sense, they're not themselves up for discussion, just as grammar, is not up for discussion. It's something that's just given. So that there's not much point in arguing about religion for Wittgenstein or ethical matters. These are things that are in a way beyond argument, because they are features of the parameters of the whole game itself. And you've either got to choose, I mean, you've got to choose either to participate in the game or not, but there aren't really rational considerations that would argue you into doing one thing rather than the other.
The language game in religion then? It's still, it's, is it meaningful to play the language game within religion? In the Tractatus, we spoke about how God talk was all ultimately, it was pointless in discussing. It was beyond the limits of our world, beyond the limits of our language. Now, in the Philosophical Investigations, is religious talk meaningful now? Is talking about God certainly within our, within the limits of our language and world?
And yeah, and just to perhaps unpack that for anybody studying the A-level. So if let's say if we took a Catholic and then so they go to Sunday Mass, and so suddenly words like Eucharist and transubstantiation and salvation and atonement and all of these ideas, when they're using them in this context with people like in their parish church, is that in that context actually meaningful in the way that they live their life?
Yes, I think the later Wittgenstein would say that it is meaningful. I mean, what he says is that he himself can't really do anything with that sort of language. So an example he gives is of the resurrection. And for, he said, what he says is roughly along the lines of, for me, the statement that Christ is risen would function as a scientific statement, and it's just false. He's dead and buried, he says. But we shouldn't think of it as a scientific statement for people who are playing the game. For them, it has a different status, so that it's not functioning as a statement would. If you said, well, my father is dead, for example. And if I then came along and said, hey, I've just seen my father, he's risen from the dead, that would be taken, at least in most contexts, as a scientific statement, and people would think I'd gone crazy or something like that. But Wittgenstein's point is that is not how we should understand a statement like Christ is risen. It's not making a move in that particular game. It's making a move in a different game. So it's not a sort of dry factual assertion about coming to life again of a physical body after it's been brain dead. It's not that kind of statement. It's got a much more mystical significance to those who use it. In a sense, there's no point in saying to a religious person, look, Christ had a body like everyone else. So when he died, that body decomposed. That is not really engaging with what people mean when they say Christ is risen.
If a young earth creationist takes kind of offense to that and says, actually, no, I'm of the belief that there was a physical body and a physical resurrection, and that, like, I do see this to be scientific fact, would Wittgenstein say then that this is no longer sort of within the realm of what the religious language game should really all be about? Are they overstepping a line there, or are they just misunderstanding what they believe to be science, and that's just the end of it?
Yes, I think he would have very little time for that. He would think that people who thought in that way were missing the point of religion. I think he would see himself in his later work, as in indeed in the Tractatus in the earlier work, he would see himself as offering religion a way out. In the modern world, offering it an escape route, if you like, offering it a way in which it can carry on its business in slightly different terms from the terms in which it's been conceived to work in the past. Because obviously in the past, people would have agreed with your creationist and said, of course this is scientific language, it's absolutely literally true that Christ rose from the dead. Wittgenstein is as it were saying, well, we can't say that any longer, that's ridiculous, but we don't have to jettison religious language because we can understand it in a different way. And effectively that's what religious people are doing, because they don't treat scientific evidence as relevant to their beliefs. I mean, a good example of that is the efficacy of prayer, I think. Various people at Dawkins, people have conducted experiments on whether prayer is efficacious and found that it's not. You don't have a better than chance, there's no better than chance likelihood of a prayer's being answered. If you say that to a religious person and show them the evidence, they're simply not going to be impressed by that. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, the point of prayer, although in prayer you do ask for things, that's not really the point of prayer to get what you ask for. At least for, I think Wittgenstein would say that's not the point of prayer for somebody who really understands religious language as it should be understood. If they really think that you're asking for something in the sense in which you might ask a parent for something or an employer, then you're missing the whole point of religion.
Does Wittgenstein still think he's solving all of the problems of philosophy in this later work as well?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I think officially he would say, no, what he says is that he's adopting a much more piecemeal approach. He's trying to solve particular problems as they come up, as they occur to him. But he does still have this very wide overarching approach to philosophical problems, so that in a sense, I think he is tackling fundamental problems, on a big scale, even though he himself might disclaim that motive. I mean, the private language argument is a good case in point. Wittgenstein officially adopts this quietist stance. He says, well, you can't advance theses in philosophy because if you did, everyone would agree with them. But advancing a thesis is exactly what he does when he says there can't be a private language. And a lot of people have disagreed with that. So he is using philosophy in the way that he did before, and most people do, to advance particular positions which it's possible for other people to disagree with.
So I wanted to ask a follow-up question with religion, and say with ethical statements. So if we went back to the Tractatus, it would seem hard to make any clear, meaningful statements on ethical statements, let's say with, just because Wittgenstein would have experienced himself. So let's say the First World War, that was a tragedy and that the deaths of millions of people was wrong. You could not say anything meaningful about that. Is his mind changed here? And would he adopt something just to say that of like a type of cultural relativism within like a particular context there? Or could he establish anything that's more maybe objective in any way?
No, I don't think he would go for cultural relativism. He did write a lecture on ethics, which was delivered and which has been published in his later life. And that more or less carries on the modest position of the Tractatus, that you can't really make substantial statements about ethics. That's actually not what language is for. If you try to say something ethical, you'll come out with either falsity or nonsense. And I think that position continues really in his later thinking as well. It's hard to say because he doesn't really talk about ethics explicitly much at all in his later work. But it seems to me that something like the Tractarian position is still very much there.
So even within like a particular culture, when they're discussing ethical arguments, for instance, they are unlike religion, where they could be having some sort of meaningful discussion within that realm, is that there's still nothing to be had there.
Well, I'm not sure that he would agree that you can have a meaningful religious discussion. It depends what you mean by that. I mean, you can certainly have moves made within the religious language game, which make sense to people who are playing that game, but don't really make sense or don't seem attractive at any rate to people who are outside the game. And I think he would say broadly the same about ethical statements.
To finish off then, there's quite a long quote here from Russell, but I'm just going to pick out the kind of core of it. So he starts off by saying that, "I've not found in Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations anything that seemed to me interesting, and I do not understand why a whole school finds important wisdom in its pages." And he later goes on to say that the later Wittgenstein, on the contrary, seems to have grown tired of serious thinking and have to have invented a doctrine in which to make such an activity unnecessary in reference to the things in which he earlier said in his earlier works that you had to pass over in silence. It appears that Russell is basically feeling like he's copped out a bit and has gone to talk at length about things that he must remain silent upon. The following questions are, why did Russell reject Wittgenstein's later work? And do we have good reason to reject Wittgenstein's work based on his criticisms?
It's interesting that Wittgenstein himself occasionally thought the same. There's one place where he says something like, I sometimes think that I'm philosophizing with toothless gums, so that he had some sympathy for Russell's criticism. Russell, of course, objected to the piecemeal approach that the later Wittgenstein has. He doesn't seem to be trying to build up a grand metaphysical system as the earlier Wittgenstein was doing. But actually, I think that Russell simply didn't engage with and didn't understand the later Wittgenstein's work. And although there's no metaphysical system building in a kind of grand Leibnizian sense, there's a continuation of engagement with profound problems, and indeed with many of the same problems that the Tractatus was concerned with. Problem of falsity is a good example. That's a deep old philosophical problem which figures both in the Tractatus and in his later thinking. Very centrally, the problem of necessity. What is necessity? Again, that figures both in his early and in his later thinking, so that he's still engaging with fundamental philosophical problems. And that's why, A, Russell was wrong, and B, we should engage ourselves with his later work.
Part 3, further analysis and discussion. My first question, why aren't we all followers of later Wittgenstein?
Very good question. I think we should be. I don't agree with everything the later Wittgenstein said, of course, but I think the broad trend of his later thought is right. And there's been, I mean, for a long time it was very influential. When I was receiving my philosophical education in the 80s, I guess, Wittgenstein was very much something that one had to engage with, that one was expected to engage with. That seems to have changed over the last couple of decades. Wittgenstein is now a figure in the history of philosophy whom you can either engage with or not, as you like. And you're not considered to be philosophically ill-educated if you don't, as you certainly were when I was being taught. And it's certainly the case that philosophy of mind in particular has really taken leave of Wittgenstein in a big way. It's very much gone back to the subjectivist Cartesian tradition that Wittgenstein was attempting to trounce. And I think that's a very regrettable development. So yes, I think we should all be followers of the later Wittgenstein.
So has later Wittgenstein in the investigations, has he solved the problems of philosophy of language conclusively? Is there anything more to be said on the matter? Is this the final word and we should just accept his word for it?
Well, I mean, yes and no. The difficult no, he hasn't solved all problems. Of course, there are other philosophical problems that he didn't discuss, and there's a lot more to say about the ones that he did discuss. And of course, there's the issue of getting out exactly what his position is. I mean, to some extent, we've skirted round that. We did a bit when we were talking about rule following. There are more realistic and less realistic interpretations of Wittgenstein on rule following. To what extent is he a realist? To what extent is he an anti-realist? He's not always consistent on these questions, so that actually working out what his position was, or at least what it was at certain stages in his life, is not that easy a matter. I think that he didn't really make enough of the context principle, either in his earlier or later writings. I think that the context principle has enormous significance in philosophy of language and metaphysics. That the way it points is towards a certain kind of realism about entities in the world which have often been attacked by anti-realists and nominalists. There's actually a slightly regrettable tendency, I think, in Wittgenstein's later thought towards nominalism. So we talked about the private language argument earlier, and of course one of the things he's attacking there is the idea that sensations are private in the sense that they could be talked about in a private language. For him, sensations are public phenomena. Mind is a public phenomenon. It's available to other people just as it is to myself, and to be talked about in a public language. But he sometimes tips over into questioning whether sensations really are proper objects, whether they really can be referred to. So he talks about the object and Yeah, he talks about the object and designation model of language, and so the referential model of language, in other words. And there are passages where he seems to doubt whether that applies to all aspects of language. And that seems to me a mistaken tendency in his later thought. So I think there are certainly areas in the philosophy of language which can move on from Wittgenstein, yes.
To what extent do you agree with Wittgenstein's early work?
Well, as I said in the earlier discussion, I'm broadly sympathetic to the idea that language and reality stand in a mirroring relationship to one another. There are a number of details of the picture theory that I think are wrong, and in particular, Wittgenstein misses out the significance of syntax. Syntax is something that language has, but the world doesn't. That's a very significant difference between them, and so is not present in the mirroring relationship. But the idea that all words are names, and that combinations of names form sentences which are true or false, these sentences are mirrored on the ground in states of affairs or propositions, which are structured in broadly similar terms, in function argument terms, as Wittgenstein himself says in the Tractatus, that seems to me to be right and very important. So that's one thing that I take out of the Tractatus, although, as I say, a number of the details, the idea that names stand proxy for objects, which is part of the picture theory. I can't remember whether we mentioned that. We should have mentioned it if we didn't. Names in some way stand in for objects in the sentence. That's got to be wrong. You couldn't have a sentence composed of tables and chairs. Wittgenstein at one point implies that you could, and that words are just a convenient tool standing in for tables and chairs. But in fact, that's not going to work. Language needs syntax. It can't be interpreted otherwise. Arrangements of objects don't say anything. So there are certainly aspects of the picture theory which seem to me to go too far, but the broad structure, it seems to me to be right.
His later work in the Philosophical Investigations, I know we touched on this slightly at the end of part two, but how far, to what extent do you agree with his later work?
Well, as I said before, I certainly agree that mind is a public phenomenon. It's not something that is in some is sort of curtained away in some inner Cartesian space. And I think that's a very important insight of his later work. And that, correlatively, that language is a public phenomenon. That seems to me important. The rule-following considerations also seem to me important, although I think one has to take them further than Wittgenstein himself does. I think one has to, if I can sort of summarize, one has to operate with a notion of the ideal, if one is to understand normativity, in a way in which I think Wittgenstein himself would have been uncomfortable with. Wittgenstein is uncomfortable in his later work with any notion of the ideal. Any kind of Platonic ideal is something that he seems to want to shy away from, and I think one can't if one is to understand normativity. So I think there are aspects of his later work that one needs to take further. I also think, as I mentioned a minute ago, that one has to jettison the nominalism, which pokes its head out now and then in his later writings. I think one has to think of all words as names of objects. These objects are all objects in as good a sense as anything is an object. Pains, sensations, they're not private objects, but they are objects, all right, and they can be referred to in language. And I think there's a certain amount of muddle in Wittgenstein's later thinking about language and privacy, but he's sort of set the basic picture, which I think we should follow, yes.
Is this idea of the mind being a public phenomenon, it seems that people who we've looked at the hard problem of consciousness a few times, episode 3, 19 and 25, it seems that there's this, what is likeness to being in my mind, and it doesn't seem like it's a public phenomenon, it seems like it's something private in my head. Does it not? So is it, are we justified in rejecting, what are the implications on that claim that the, so if we say the mind is a public phenomenon, what are the implications of that on the hard problem of consciousness?
There is no hard problem of consciousness is the short answer to that question. And I actually have an article just coming out in Mind on the idea of what its likeness. I think that the whole idea of what its likeness has been completely misunderstood in the recent philosophy of mind, and that reading Wittgenstein can actually help us correct that error. So there are things that it is like to be in a particular mental state, but the notion of what its likeness is a comparative notion, and we can say what it's like. So to give an example from Locke, for example, you might say that seeing a flash of brilliant red is like hearing the sound of a trumpet. That's what it's like. What philosophers of mind have meant, what they've wanted to get at, is some notion of what its likeness that is not expressible in words, not expressible in public language, somehow, but something that I myself am acquainted with from my own case. Mm-hmm. And it's that whole idea that Wittgenstein unpicks.
So you think the hard problem of consciousness, it's just a linguistic confusion, to summarize
your
position?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, we'll leave that there.
Yeah,
that's a nice way to leave that.
To be fair, there was a lot of that discussion on the...
Concluding remarks, I'd like to conclude with, I think it's looking at the value, not only the content of the text over the course of this discussion. We've continually raised the question, you know, for the Tractatus, if this does not work, what's the value in studying it? And there's something self-fulfilling about reading these texts and figuring out the implications of them, how we've just been doing, for example, with the private language argument. And it seems that both texts go beyond the philosophy of language in so many different aspects. And it's not only a point of scholarly interest in doing it for its own sake, but it seems to tell us other truths about the world when we study them. I don't want to ramble. I want to keep my point. No, I think it's been a fascinating discussion. I'd like to thank you, Richard, for taking part in it.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
I mean, I'll keep mine short and sweet then. I quite like, I'll certainly want to be reading far more Wittgenstein in the future, but just off the small amount that I have researched myself, I quite admire any philosopher that is prepared to look at where we draw the line. I found it interesting you said that the kind of debate has gone back to the like Cartesian dualism earlier, and the fact that there seems to be this want in philosophy and other areas where you kind of want to keep discussing these points that could just end up going on endless loops, and almost having someone like Wittgenstein to come in and say enough's enough is sometimes quite nice. It almost resets things, and I think philosophy can learn a lot from that message.
Let us pause once again to hear from our fantastic sponsors, the New College of the Humanities.
I was born in Canada and went to international schools, and I grew up in a few different countries, which was an experience I really enjoyed, and something that I'm enjoying about NCH is the different people here. As soon as I heard the name New College of the Humanities, I knew it was something that might be interesting to me. The relationship that NCH had with me, even during the application process, was different from all the other universities. It reflects sort of values that NCH holds, making sure there's a good community and that people are having fun, as well as like being really hardworking. A.C. Grayling would come and do a few lectures, and those were particularly enjoyable because he really knows what he's talking about, and he always seems to get everyone really engaged in these stories that he's telling, because Anthony's just got that way about him. When I was applying to NCH, there's obviously uncertainty about what you're going to get, because it's a new institution and it doesn't have the sort of established reputation that some of the other universities I was applying to had. It's obviously a really big package that NCH is trying to deliver to students, and it comes off really well when you're telling someone about that as a pitch for university, but to see that it actually works in practice was definitely not surprising, but oh, this institution is actually doing everything that it set out that they were going to do.
You can still apply directly or through UCAS to NCH London for 2018 entry and be considered for a scholarship worth up to £2,000 per year. Find out more at nchlondon.ac.uk/panpsycast. NCH London, unique degrees for curious minds.
You can find the link to the New College of the Humanities on our website as well as in the iTunes description.
Pop, 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 pop,
philosophy quiz.
So it's called Pop Pop Philosophy Quiz, and we pick three different scholars and the main scholar that we've looked at today. So we've got we're playing Wittgenstein. So we've got quotes from Whitney Elizabeth Houston, the American singer, actress, producer, and model. In 2009, the Guinness World Records cited her as the most awarded female act of all times. In the GAN, we've got Gandhi, who lived between 1869 and 1948.
That's good, not GAN.
Well, yeah, we were stretching it.
He's the leader of the Indian independence movement against the British rule. And we've got R.L. Stein, born in 1943. He's the author of hundreds of horror fiction novels, including the Goosebumps series. And finally, we've got Ludwig Wittgenstein, the Austrian-British philosopher of logic, mathematics, mind, and language. So you've got quotes from each. You can play, we'll play like a communist version where you work together.
We're going to try and guess. Okay.
Just try. I'll give you a few. Okay. In a gentle way, you can shake the world.
I'm going to go Whitney Houston.
No.
Gandhi.
That's Gandhi. That's 1-0. We're going to change it. We'll do scores. Richard, 1-0. Read. Just don't read one type of book. Read different books by various authors so that you develop different styles.
That'll be R.L. Stein.
Yeah, that's all right. That's 1-1. I finally faced the fact that it isn't a crime not having friends. Being alone means you have fewer problems. You can't glance over at the screen.
I'm not doing such
I thing. Think that's your popular chanteuse.
Whitney Houston.
Oh, Whitney Houston. Yes, that is Whitney Houston. There we go. We have 2-1. We'll play first of three. The world is all that is the case.
Wittgenstein.
Oh, there we go. 2-2. And the decider. A man is but the product of his thoughts, what he thinks he becomes.
That's Gandhi.
That's Gandhi. I'm sorry, Richard, you've been pipped to the post on the last one there. It's not a quiz want to win. It's not a.
Also, I think that. What's the direct quote there? Because I think Gandhi's misquoted saying, like, that thing. It's like a.
There's no point. A man is but the product of his thoughts, what he thinks he becomes.
Yeah, I think that might be the correct one. There's one like...
It's from Goodreads.
So it's got to be
right. It's got to be reliable. Thank you for listening to this episode of the PanSciCast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a review on the iTunes store. It goes a long way in helping the show. Tweet us your thoughts at the PanSciCast on Twitter. We're always eager to hear your thoughts on the show and suggestions for future episodes. All of the reading, including links to the Tractatus and the Philosophical Investigations, as well as links to Professor Gaskin's work, can be found at thepansicast.com.
Thank you. You've been listening to the voices of Mr. Jack Sides.
If a lion could talk, we could not understand him.
Professor Richard Gaskin.
The agreement, the harmony of thought and reality consists in this. If I say falsely that something is red, then for all that, it isn't red.
And me, Andrew Horton. What we cannot speak about, we must pass over in silence.